Welcome to Book Talk. This is Alan Farley, and this week it's all about Murder in Paris. Stay tuned. With me today is Cara Black, here with her latest Amy LeDuc investigation, Murder in the Palais Royal. Welcome back to Book Talk.
Well, thank you, Alan. It's great to be back.
Your 10th.
Yes.
And in being published now in a great new format, too.
Yeah, I really like the cover. Yes, this is the 10th in the series, and it's, I say, springtime in Paris, almost time for crime.
Well, what was the inspiration for this one?
You know, I wanted to write about the Palais Royal for a long time. I love this district in Paris, this wonderful garden in the center that's really kind of tucked away and right across from the Louvre. And it's a story I've wanted to write about for a long time as well. It's when people say the 10th book, but it's really in a period of 4 years. The first book, Murder in the Marais, takes place November 1993, and now we're all the way in November of 1997, but only 4 years in the fictional life of my Amy LeDuc has passed. And we find things that lead back to the first investigation.
Well, it starts rather stunningly with her assistant Renee being shot, and it looks like it's Amy who's actually shot him, and in fact she's tracked down and accused of shooting him. What gave you this idea?
Well, I don't really know where the idea came from, but I was always thinking, you know, I think it's really important to put your characters in trouble. A British author said, you know, just put your character up in the tree and then throw stones at them, and then the character will climb to the next branch and throw bigger stones, and they climb higher and higher. I think it really makes a great tension, but it needs to be rooted in the story. And, you know, I do think this is character-driven story, and Renee is part of Amy's family. He's her best friend, her partner, and family is very important to Amy because her father's passed away in that explosion, and her mother left them when she was 8 years old, who is this American mother who's on the world watch list. So there's also this undercurrent or this thread of family throughout the book as well.
Well, and Renee is a dwarf, which we didn't talk about last time, but how did you choose to make him a dwarf?
Oh, yeah, Rene's a dwarf. He's a computer hacker extraordinaire, but he suffers often from hip dysplasia, which is very common in people of his size. He comes from when I was working in a preschool here in San Francisco. I was a teacher, and we were going to hire another teacher. I was on a hiring committee, and we had many applicants, and they all had the credentials and the experience, and one of the applicants was a dwarf. And I remember thinking, you know, she's not much taller than some of our four-year-olds. There's a lot of, you know, lifting and physicality, you know, in a preschool. And I will admit that part of me thought, you know, what if, you know, the children made fun of her or something? So shamefully, that's what I thought. She didn't get picked to be hired. And then about 2 months later, I was at our sister preschool downtown for a meeting. I went a little early because I heard there was a great new teacher there who was doing this art project. So I thought, oh, I can go and get some pointers. And went in early. I sat down, and all the children were really engaged at the table, and they were working with art. And I was thinking, where's the teacher? Where's the teacher? And then I saw her, the woman who had applied in our school. And it just struck me, and I sat back and I thought, what was I looking at? I was looking at her disability, not her ability. And I really felt guilty. I thought, what about our children? You know, the experiences they could have had, they would have learned so much. And so maybe I'm expiating my guilt. but
It's great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Great point. And yeah. I mean, he's a great character.
Thank you. Yeah, he's a very natty dresser as well, yes.
Well, now, and of course it isn't Amy who shot him, but it's someone who knows all about Amy, who dresses to look like her and knows intimate details of her life.
That's right, but we can't say who it is, can we?
No, we wouldn't want to give that away.
Yeah, I think it's this. It's a person, again, it deals with family issues and an obsession. In the background, just to give you the story of the book, the place and time. So it's October 1997, 2 months after Princess Diana's death in the car crash. So there were still the headlines everywhere. It was also the time of Maurice Papon's trial in Bordeaux. He was in the Vichy government. He collaborated with the Germans, signed orders for Jews to be deported, but he had held high positions in the government. Meanwhile, I mean, for years he had evaded jurisdiction. So this trial was going on in Bordeaux. So a lot of things were coming up about the past and about the collaboration and about things people wanted to keep secret, things in families that people never talked about. So I think there again is that thread of the family and how you know, the past, the sins of the fathers can reflect, you know, their children.
And it's interesting that is something that happened in your very first novel.
That's right.
Sort of figures in this novel as well.
It does. It does. This investigation takes Amy back to the first novel, Murder in the Marais, to the burning of the synagogue. And it sort of kind of parallels the journey she makes through the book, to what happened in that past and the journey she's going on, you know, as a human being.
Well, tell us about more about the Palais Royal and why you wanted to set it there. I think you've told us before that the setting is what something that makes you want to write about it.
Right. Yeah, it's a place I go when I get to Paris. When I first went to Paris many years ago, I went there because I made my little homage to Colette, the writer who lived there. And there's something so peaceful about this place. It's an oasis right in the middle of Paris. And it's got these wonderful arcades that go all the way around. And there's a fountain. And I think there's something about it that speaks of the past. It has this decayed aristocratic feeling to it. And they have the Ministry of Culture, the Comédie Française, the Conseil d'État. But you might remember it from the film 1963 with Charade, with Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant. The big shootout scene with Walter Matthau under these shadowy arcades. That's the Palais Royal.
Uh-huh.
And I've always wanted to, you know, I thought it was so evocative. I've always wanted to go back there, and I thought, someone has to be killed there. You
know? Well, that's right. You've got to have murder. Murder is in the title of every one of your novels.
Yes, that's right. I have to kill them all over Paris. So I've got about 9 more arrondissements to go.
Well, I guess you're not going to make Paris the murder capital like Colin Dexter did with Oxford. Which is his Inspector Morris novels in such a small place. But still... And we talked about before that when you started writing, you decided you wanted to write in the crime area, but I'm not sure we explored why exactly you decided that was the best way to write about Paris and the darker side of Paris.
Darker side of the City of Light. No, that's a good point. I wanted to tell the story in my first book, Murder in the Marais, about my friend's mother, who was a hidden Jewish girl in the Marais during the German occupation. And she was 14 years old. She came home from school one day in 1943, and the apartment was empty. And kept thinking her family was coming back, because in 1943, they didn't know what we know today. Long story short, she went to school every day, came home, lived there. The concierge helped her with food coupons for heat, for charcoal and food. And in 1944, at liberation, she went to the Hotel Lutetia and found out that her parents had been taken to Auschwitz. Anyway, that story really stayed with me. When I went back 10 years later to France, I went back to the Marais, and that story came back to me. My son was young at the time. And I remember thinking, you know, what would I have done if I had lived then? What would I have done to put food on the table for him? You know, there's things that we do under, we've never been occupied. So I thought, how could I frame that story, excuse me, and tell it? I couldn't write literary fiction. You know, I was just a mom, you know, a preschool teacher. I didn't really have any training, but I was burning to tell this story. So I started taking writing classes at UC Berkeley Extension, got into a writing group. And when I was also doing this, one of the mothers who'd been in my Lamaze group said, you know, you should read some of these mysteries. They're pretty good. And I hadn't read mysteries since Nancy Drew. So I was like, really?
Yeah, I started with the Hardy Boys myself.
There you go. So she gave me these great mysteries. One of them was Sue Dunlap's, I can't remember the title, who has this detective in Berkeley. And I was like, wow, it's like Nancy Drew grew up and had a gun. And it's very cool. And the women can do these things. So I thought, okay, maybe I could frame it, you know, using the detective novel as a framework, a structure to tell the story. Then I was also reading a lot of P.D. James, which Baroness P.D. James.
Yes.
Wonderful. And these are so much more than crime novels. Not that that's not okay, but they call it crime fiction in Britain. Excuse me. And these are stories using the crime fiction as a framework to tell a story. And I thought, you get social realism here, you get psychological depth, you get setting, you get this incredible dialogue. Well, why don't I try that? You know, thinking it would be easy, which of course it wasn't.
Well, but of course I'm thinking about television too, and certainly some of the most popular programs on television have crime as the basis. I mean, the CSI series, the Law and Order series. And they're addictive.
They're addictive. You know, I think partly because in real life we don't get any resolution. I mean, this is a simple example, but I went out to get my car and I had been rear-ended. And, of course, the person had driven away. So I have, you know, insurance. I went to get it covered, but there's a $100 deductible. Now, that was the $100 deductible out of my pocket. And, of course, I wanted to, you know, kick the person who did it. Instead, I had Amy do it. There's a, you know, we're searching for some resolution we don't get in real life. And maybe that's satisfying. Not all the loose ends are tied up or the threads knotted, but some form of justice is served.
We're talking with Cara Black about Murder in the Palais Royal, the latest in her Amy Leduc investigations. Well, now, Amy Leduc, I guess it was two novels ago, her fiancé was killed off. Is there a reason that she doesn't get a long-term relationship with a man?
Well, she likes bad boys, Alan, you know, and that's always problematic, you know. And I don't know, you know, there may be hope for a Melek in this book if you, yes. We'll see. I think it's quite difficult to write a story with people with a relationship, and I admire people who do. Because, again, you have someone who's working on a murder case, who gets involved in dangerous situations, and then there's that inconvenient spouse at home wanting dinner, you know. And so I think that's really something, and I think some writers do it very, very well. I just don't know if that will be the case for Amy.
Yeah, well, I can't think of a detective who has a long-term relationship. I mean, Inspector Morse always falls in love with someone who turns out to be the villain, usually, right, or gets murdered.
Right.
And although it looks like Dalgliesh might actually be having a long-term relationship with it, obviously that series is nearing its end as well.
Right.
So, yeah, and in the television series, it doesn't seem to happen. In fact, when it does, it's sort of a turnoff, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of the dramatic impact of the series.
Right, the sexual tension is gone. And I know a lot of my friends in Paris, the Parisians, I mean, these are wonderful-looking women, witty, charming, bright, smart. And, you know, I meet them after work in a cafe, and they're like, you know, they don't even have a date. And I'm thinking, whoa, well, there's no hope for the rest of us. But, you know, I mean, I think everywhere it's an issue.
So. Well, tell us more about Commander Morbier.
Okay. He, when I write Morbier, who's Amy's godfather, the commissaire in the police force, I visualize the actor Philippe Noiret, who I'm sure you know him, you've seen him in many, many films. Wonderful actor who has sadly passed away. But he is a big man. He's got the baggy eyes and the jowly cheeks, and he's gruff, and he's very smart, and he's, you know, got that mustard stain on his jacket lapel. And he was Amy's father's first partner when they were on the beat many years ago on the cobblestones. So he is her godfather. And he obviously knows a lot more about Amy's past and her mother and what happened to her father than he reveals to Amy, which is always a bone of contention for them. And she goes to him for help, and sometimes he gives it and sometimes very grudgingly. He's really tired in this book of getting her out of hot water.
Right, because I was wondering, well, now why? What can he do for her? Why doesn't he do more?
Why doesn't he do more? Because he thinks she should settle down and raise a family and stop all this business.
Well, and that, I mean, her computer security is supposedly her business.
Right.
Though she gets involved in these murders.
Right. Well, she was trained as a PI. She has her qualifications. And she was helping her father at Le Duc Detective when she was actually in medical school and had gone through a first year of pre-med. And then her father, and she found she couldn't take that. And then she started helping her father more in the detective agency. When he was killed during a bomb explosion in the Place Vendôme, she vowed no more criminal work. So at that time, her friend Renee was at the Sorbonne, and she said, well, let's turn this into computer security, very cutting edge in the mid-1990s. So that's where it really evolved. And she, of course, has this network of these old police, these fleeks, as they call them, the old boy network. She knows how it works. She doesn't like it. But she's often calls on them to get something done. And she doesn't trust the police. No one in Paris trusts the police, really.
Why is that?
Well, it's really interesting. There's another name for them, not only les flics. They call them les poulets. The chickens. And it's really not a derogatory term. It means that where the prefecture is, 36 Quai des Orfèvres, which you probably know from Georges Simenon's books, the Inspector Maigret novels, the main Paris prefecture, it used to be where there was a chicken market in medieval times. So les poulets, you know, are the... not in a bad way. I mean, I've even heard them say this to each other, so... I don't know. I think when you're there's not a lot of respect for the police. I have to say I'm a bit surprised. I have friends who are police women, and I think there's more respect for the Brigade Criminelle, who are the more elite, you know, the homicide bureau that are out of the prefecture, because these also the Brigade Criminelle has more power. You know, they can get things done. They can cross the different arrondissements, whereas a regular beat fleek, he has a standard, he cannot go much further than patrolling the beat and taking statements and interviewing suspects. Last time I was in Paris, I got to visit a police station and was in a lineup.
Really?
Yeah. It was a very strange situation. I was meeting my friend there to meet the policeman, and they showed me into a room with all these elderly people, and they all smiled and talked to me, and then they said, well, it's your turn now to go in. This was all in French, and I said, oh, to meet them? No, to see the suspect. Actually, there had been a lot of purse snatchings. And so they had all these elderly people had been robbed, and they were going in to pick the suspects from the lineup. So I said, oh, I don't think that's why I'm here. And so we had this. But later they let me go in the lineup room and stand there. It was really fun.
Well, now you've used a few French terms, and you use French terms from time to time in the novel. When do you decide to use something in French without explaining?
Good question. And I aim to sprinkle it like seasoning to give us the flavor. I mean, it is written in English.
Right.
And these people are in France talking to each other. So I like to give that little soupçon, that flavor. And I hope I do it so people who don't know French, don't speak French, can understand to give the meaning in the context. That's what I'm always aiming for.
Are the books published in France?
Two of them are, yes. Yes.
What kind of reactions have you had?
Pretty interesting. People seem they like it. They say, well, she's a young, not Inspector Maigret, but, you know, a young, hip, contemporary Parisienne. And, you know, they say that I think the highest compliment I got was, you know your geography. You got it right. And I went, thank you.
So, well, is there much detective fiction published in French?
Oh, a lot of detective fiction. Fred Vargas is very famous and I think quite well-known over here and in Europe. She's actually a woman and a medieval scholar, but writes these very gritty, dark, I guess we'd call them hard-boiled detective novels. She has a policeman. She's very big there. There's other French writers, too.
And what about translation? I mean, the English writers in
France? Oh, huge, yeah. Huge. Michael Connelly is huge in Paris. At the train station, at the Gare du Nord, you see the Michael Connelly books. Deborah Crombie is very big there. Agatha Christie, I have seen whole windows in bookstores on her, you know, the anniversary of her birthday or something. All her novels in the bookstore. I mean, they love Agatha Christie. They really, really do.
Did you grow up reading Agatha Christie?
I grew up reading Nancy Drew with the flashlight under the covers. My father was the mystery reader. When he retired, he would read a mystery book a day. And I kept saying, why are you reading all those books? And he said, well, you should try one. They're pretty good. He was reading a lot of P.D. James.
So. I would generally have to take longer than a day to read a P.D. James.
Yeah.
but something like Agatha Christie in a day or Lee Child, which is so involving, it's hard to put down.
Lee Child is great. Yeah, the last one about New York, I read it on the plane coming back from New York. It was so cool.
We're talking with Cara Black about her latest Amy LeDuc mystery, Murder in the Palais Royal. Well, you know, it's a really complicated story here with all the ramifications, and there's more than just that one story involved in the storyline. How did you work it all out?
I have no idea.
As you went well, along?
Yeah, I'm not an outliner. I'm a sort of seat-of-the-pants kind of person. When I start a book, I start with the place, this particular part of Paris, this district, this quartier that's unique, and not that everywhere isn't unique, but there's something about it that speaks to me. Either I know it a little bit or I know nothing about it, but I'm intrigued because of something that happened there or something I've read in the newspaper or something my friend has told me about her great aunt who'd lived there. And it's something about it that pulls me. And then I have to think, why would this crime happen in this part of Paris? Why would it be unique to this place? Who lives here? What would make it organic to the plot? So when I find that, then I think, okay, well then why would Amy LeDuc, my detective, get involved? What is her connection to this? Which could be many different reasons. And then the story sort of goes from there. It also kind of deals with what's happening in France at that time. And so then I write about 100 pages and I sit down and go, is this really going anywhere? Is this really a story? Is this making some sense? And then I start to do a timeline. For me, I do it by days of the week and different times of the day and where Amy would be or Rene or her godfather Morbier and what's happening behind the scenes. And then I really feel, okay, I think I've got a story here, and this is what I want to see about this place. I have had killers change on me.
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, the connection with your other novels is really fascinating.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, Amy's on some kind of journey, you know, and this sort of deals with some of that. Maybe subconsciously I was aiming to go there, and it just took me 10 books to do it. I don't know.
Well, now, is this in a different arrondissement than the other nine novels?
So? Yes. This is in the first arrondissement, which is where the Louvre is and the Tuileries and the Comédie Française, and it's also where her office is, because her office is on Rue du Louvre, a few blocks away. And it was an area that really presented a few challenges, because it's the highest concentration of single people live in this district. They publish all these statistics, but in other areas, you know, they have families. But here we're single people. It has a lot of state buildings, you know, government buildings, the Ministry of Culture, the Cour de Cassation, the Banque de France. So a lot of government buildings, and to find the human part of it, which drew me, was to the garden at the Palais Royal, which is this garden, this little village, as Colette called it. And you know, it's Paris is a collection of villages. And it was about finding that unique voice, that flavor here. And then I just loved it. And it has these little shops that have been there forever. And when I first started going to the Palais Royal, they had the metal shops, you know, with war medals or Legion d'honneur and the ribbons. And they were very dusty, and, you know, that only old, doddering, ancien regime types will go there to refresh their medals. And it's changed, and there are shops selling the little black dresses, you know, the vintage shops. There's a perfume shop. So it is getting more gentrified and more trendy. But it's still just a wonderful place to sit by the fountain and talk with the woman next to you who's feeding the pigeons, and, you know.
Well, is it any bit of a problem since you're still setting these back 10 or 12, 13 years from now of going there today and trying to figure out what was it like 12 years ago or 13 years ago?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I was there 12 or 13 years ago. I didn't take detailed notes, as I remember. But I remember going, my friend said, you really need to check this out. So I went to the Ministry of Culture and met the man who handles all the public relations, I guess. And I said, so I need to understand if you had these surveillance cameras. They have just a very few there, but that's really important to know, which they had very few of in that era at that time. And I was saying, would that video camera be there at this time? You know, kind of important to know if someone could be caught. Would this be happening? Was the garden gated? Of course, it's a public garden, but gated at night, locked. But the access to it under these arcades, excuse me, are cut off because it belongs to the Ministry of Culture in some areas. Would these have been locked at that time? And even he was saying, gee, you know, I don't know. He tried to find someone who could remember. So there are things that we just have to hope that are plausible. And that, he said, you know, I think what you propose would work. So there are those kind of issues. And of course, at the time, there was a shop here. I do have phone books from that period. So I have the Yellow Pages and the White Pages of Paris. So I can sort of check if a shop was there. Of course, they could have gone out of business in the meantime. But I do try to use what I can and make it as real as I can.
How much time do you spend in Paris?
Never enough. But I go usually twice a year. I have a friend and I sleep on her couch. And I've made friends over the years with police, retired policemen, private detectives, women detectives, cafe owners, basically anyone who will meet with me and talk with me. And you know, talk with them about what they do, what could happen. I had a tour of this police station last time, and I did last year was taken, got a ride. I went to Versailles, but of course not the Chateau of Versailles. I went to the what we would call a special ops post, the sort of Navy SEALs, our version sort of the Navy SEALs, the elite SWAT team who took me into their whole installation and showed me how they take out hostages, you know, from the airplane simulations, and even let me fire a gun in their firing range.
Well, what's the next, Amy Leduc?
The next one is Murder in Passy, Passy. It's a part of Paris. It's in the 16th arrondissement, which is very chichy, very kind of upper class, kind of very bourgeois. And it's the part of Passy, which is just the other side of the Seine. And it's it has this village-like feel to it that attracted me. That's where Balzac lived. It's where he would go and hide from his creditors.
Well, we look forward to that.
I
see that on March 1st, you're going to be reading at M for Mystery in San Mateo.
Yes, I am. M is for Mystery.
And we've been talking with Cara Black. The novel is Murder in the Palais Royal. It's published by Soho. Book Talk is now available as a podcast. You can receive an MP3 of Book Talk every week free of charge for your MP3 player or home computer. Links to subscribe to all of KALW's local podcasts are available at kalw.org. And that's Book Talk for this week. This is Alan Farley. Thank you for listening.